Why did Britain declare war on Germany in 1914? The Great War was the beginning of the end of the British Empire. Britain's involvement in that conflict engorged what was then a European war into a world war. It prolonged that war and ensured that it became a European cataclysm. It marked the beginning of the crisis of confidence in European civilization and the emergence of Soviet communism. Indeed, it is impossible to imagine the causes of the Second World War without looking at the legacy of the First. The legacy of that war, moreover, fundamentally transformed British society, changing forever the relationship between the British state and subject. It has always fascinated me. Why was Britain so determined to stampede into the jaws of hell? I have long made references on this channel that Britain's entry into the conflict seemed antithetical to both any grand strategy of empire and the desire to preserve a British way of life. This isn't merely a view conceived of with the benefit of hindsight. Strategically, and with regards to the devastation of European culture, it was readily apparent to many contemporaries, even if the human toll of industrial warfare was drastically underestimated. If Britain's goal was the peace of Europe, her diplomatic and, more precisely, Edward Grey's ambivalence to both her would-be allies and enemies intensified the stakes of the July crisis and helped spark the war in Europe. If Britain's goal was to allow, if not instigate, a war of proxies between her main European rivals, France, Germany, and Russia, all Britain needed to do was sit on the sidelines, her competitors weakened, and Britain in a position of relative strength. In the event of a protracted conflict between these rivals, the most likely outcome in 1914, Britain could have imposed a European peace from a position of strength and to suit her own interests. Such was the logic of Britain's strategic partnership with France and Britain's victory against Russia in the Great Game, when Russia suffered her greatest defeat at the hands of the Japanese, a British ally and proxy for defeating Russia. The three great continental powers at war may have ensured Britain's enduring commercial and maritime dominance, as were the results of the Napoleonic Wars. Instead, Britain opted to join a side, fight to a stalemate, and lose hundreds of thousands of fighting men in the process, and ultimately to rely on deliverance from the United States. What makes this all the more remarkable is that I believe Britain could not have avoided war by the end of July, days before the official declaration. And this is a consequence of Britain's political system. Ironically, to preserve the British pre-war society, economically liberal, predicated on maritime commerce, sustained by naval dominance, and marked by the absence of a large standing army, would have required something truly novel, an autocrat or statesman of a Cromwellian stature, to silence the warhawks and place the long-term interests of the empire ahead of the capricious impulses of the political classes. Obviously, such a figure did not exist in 1914. Despite having won a historic victory against the Conservatives in the landslide election of 1906, the Liberals, as a result of Lloyd George's People's Budget and their fight to demote the House of Lords, had lost their parliamentary majority and were reliant on support from Labour and the Irish Home Rule Party. Labour were then a pacifist party. The Liberal Party was deeply divided on the cause of war. Asquith, the Prime Minister, was made in the mould of an arbitrator rather than that of a leader, focused on the preservation of the Liberal Party in office. The war hawk, principal war hawk in his administration, was Sir Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, originally a conservative who had defected. Next to him was the Foreign Secretary, Edward Grey. Edward Grey, though ostensibly a liberal, was lauded by the conservatives for his quote-unquote bipartisan foreign policy. Though the most significant voice in the cabinet was that of the Chancellor, Lloyd George, a leading advocate for peace during the Boer War, who had drifted into the anti-German camp during the Second Moroccan Crisis, and whose belated support for the war in 1914 was critical in committing the Liberal government to that cause. Had Asquith ignored the opinions of his most prominent cabinet members, his government would have undoubtedly fallen, which is why, inevitably, he allied himself firmly to the Warhawks. The Conservative Party had already committed itself to war, so any split in the Liberal Party would have accelerated Britain's involvement in the conflict. Indeed, this occurred during the course of the conflict in 1916, when Lloyd George split the Liberals and formed a new government with Conservative backing. It should be clear, then, that given the prevailing forces in 1914, that war, no matter how irrational, was inevitable. I have decided to take this point as my first principle and work backwards, examining the Conservatives' rationale for war. Despite the fact that the British Empire, the largest empire in world history, that would eventually come to span a quarter of the world's landmass, it never developed a coinciding imperial ideology. Certainly that wasn't to be found in the monarchy or the Anglican Church. The Conservative Party, under Robert Peel, which was technically founded in the 1840s, began on the idea of expanding free trade by the abolition of the Corn Laws, in turn betraying many of the old Tory base. It wasn't until the advance of the career of Disraeli in the 1860s and the 1870s that the Conservative Party pivoted towards an imperial ideology, or rather you can say a imperial populism, to appeal to the new expanded conservative base of which Disraeli was personally responsible for enfranchising with the 1867 Reform Act. So having gone from the advocates for free trade, the Conservative Party of Disraeli and his successors occupied this awkward position of prevaricating between the positions of tariff reform, moving towards a economic union within the British Empire, or at least pertaining to the British Isles, and standing for the expansion of free trade, which is one of the cause celebres of the British Empire, and a justification for Britain's maritime dominance, being able to access new foreign markets. Disraeli was in many ways responsible for galvanising Britain into this new advocacy for empire and being able to consolidate Britain's position with the purchase of the Suez Canal, a position which would ultimately be facilitated by Gladstone, ironically, and the annexation of Egypt. But by the time of Lord Salisbury, Foreign Secretary under Disraeli and later Prime Minister, Britain has adopted an imperial strategy known as splendid isolationism. Isn't isolationism in a literal sense, but rather an aloof detachment from hard European alliances. That is not to say that Britain didn't advocate a firm position in foreign affairs. Disraeli was known for his brinkmanship, very famously during the standoff against Russia, during the Congress of Berlin, and trying to ensure that Russia would not have a naval base in the Mediterranean. So the Conservative Party has been trying to discover a formula regarding using the empire and mobilising its massive support, coinciding with these two positions. The position adjoining that is the position of unionism, ensuring that the United Kingdom of Great Britain and all of Ireland would remain. This came to a head in the 1880s with the advance of Charles Parnell's Irish Home Rule Party and Gladstone's Road to Damascus moment where he converts to the policy of Irish Home Rule. Why this flew in the face of the conservative imperialists was the idea of decentralisation or autonomy within the British Isles would then set a precedent for the devolution autonomy and ultimately the end of the British Empire. If the British Isles couldn't remain united, what precedent would that set for the rest of the empire? So this measure within the Liberal Party split, and the most prominent of the unionists within the Liberal Party, Joseph Chamberlain, goes over to the Conservative side, albeit not formally part of the Conservative Party yet. So there is this instance where the rejection of Home Rule is coinciding with attempting to buttress an ideology of empire, and that being a Conservative vote-winning mechanism. Splendid isolation, indeed, is a very effective policy when one looks at the fact that Britain was able to win the scramble for Africa. France and its empire, when it was essentially permitted to have an empire, was nothing more than the scraps left over by the British, occupying the deserts in the Sahara and in strategically important position in Indochina, but was ultimately insignificant when one compares it to the expanse of the British Raj or even the British positions in Malaysia combined to the white settler colonies of Canada, Australia, and eventually New Zealand. Why am I bringing all this up? Well, there is a growing sentiment within the Conservative Party over the future identity of the empire, where the empire is eventually evolving into. Is it evolving into an imperial federation? Or following the precedent set in Canada, is the empire instead going to follow the model of increased decentralization and ultimately union through the monarchy and nothing else, which ultimately transpires? The galvanizing moment in this is the Boer War, which can be seen as the apex for British imperialism into Africa, when Britain goes into the Transvaal Republics, where there has just been a discovery of massive amounts of gold. The British response, of course, is a consequence of the whole nature of the British Empire. The British Empire in its administration, it's very decentralized. So after a few bungled operations on the ground, Britain becomes heavily involved in the Boer War. Lord Salisbury holds an election in 1900 and is able to ensure a massive majority for the Conservative Party. But nevertheless, by 1902, it is clear that the British Empire has not won the resounding victory that it had hoped and had to resort to extreme measures such as interning the Boer populations into concentration camps in order to ensure victory. Nevertheless, it is various figures from that period in the Boer War that will later come to dominate the ideological makeup, the policy making for future integration within the British Empire, using South Africa as a litmus test. South Africa will come from, will form from a confederation of various colonies into a single union, that of South Africa. One of the figures most central to this is Lord Milner, who will form Milner's Kindergarten, which in itself is a successor to the organisations of Cecil Rhodes, looking at this idea of forming into an imperial confederation, and this is then succeeded by the ideas of the British Round Table, the British Round Table moots. And this is also coinciding with another reform in the Conservative Party. These movements are adjacent, they're not directly affiliated, but these things pertain regarding Britain's imperial identity and the developments going on in the Conservative Party. Because after the Boer War and the financial strain and the human strain this has put on the empire in terms of the loss of its prestige, one possible reform to this is the idea of putting form imperial preference, the idea of creating a single market for the British Empire, albeit not in such grandiose terms. It will very much be a haphazard process in order to prioritise goods from the empire as opposed to prioritising goods from without the empire, particularly Germany and the United States. And indeed, this wasn't a novel proposal. This was, if anything, a reaction compared to similar measures in Germany and in the United States of America. But despite the moderation of this proposal, which was headed by Joseph Chamberlain, long-running colonial secretary at that time, the issue bitterly divided the Conservative Party from 1903 under the weak leadership of Arthur Balfour, who was essentially a nepotistic successor of Lord Salisbury, one of the last effective prime ministers of the United Kingdom, and the last to have any cogent strategy for the succession of the British Empire. And it is off the back of these various failures, and you can see the failure of various associated groups such as Milner's Kindergarten to come up with a coherent policy for the reintegration, consolidation of the empire after the experience of the Boer War, that helps the Liberals achieve a historic victory in 1906, when the Conservative government had collapsed due to these failed arguments over tariffs in 1905. So from 1906 up until 1916, the Conservative Party, having dominated British politics since the 1870s, now finds itself out of government. The Liberals do not have a very clear ideology either, but Edward Grey follows the precedent of his Conservative predecessor, Lord Lansdowne. Lord Lansdowne was responsible for the Entente Cordiale between Britain and France that ultimately lessened the tensions between these two empires and allowed Britain to continue to run its empire on the cheap when the maintenance of colonies in Africa and India had become to cost more than the British were able to gain through economic exploitation, etc. So the Conservatives in exile are trying to galvanize a new ideology for empire. They never drop the idea of tariff reform. Tariff reform remains on the agenda from 1903 up until 1912 and further beyond. But what figures more prominently on the agenda by 1912, 1913 is the issue of Home Rule, coming back to the nascent Conservative association with empire and the Conservatives receiving the Liberal Unionists into the government benches, and Joseph Chamberlain, of course, himself being a Liberal Unionist, that would split the two parties. Why am I bringing this all up? Because when the Liberals push through a series of radical reforms in 1910, a radical reform involving the People's Budget regarding the expansion of taxes and the Parliamentary Reform Act that would ensure the House of Lords would become little more than a roadblock to reform, a temporary roadblock to reform, rather than being able to provide an absolute veto on legislation going forward. During the contentious series of elections in 1910, two elections were held in that year to justify the parliamentary reform and allow King George V to sign off on it. The Conservatives have made considerable gains, but ultimately this reflected the fears of the Unionists and of the pro-imperial party, in that the Irish Home Rule Party was now forced, along with Labour, to support the weakened Liberals. That meant for the first time, Irish Home Rule was on the agenda and was passing various stages through the House of Commons and could no longer be vetoed through the House of Lords, which had been a stumbling block during the 1880s. So, on the one hand, the Conservatives are not in the driving position to dictate Britain's imperial policy, which is confused under the Liberal government, decentralised in a way, and figures such as Edward Grey are essentially allowed to run Britain's foreign policy with virtual independence from the central government, which is all the more remarkable. But it is the issue of Home Rule which represents a galvanising moment for the Conservatives to react potentially violently against the government. In 1914, there are a series of instances where it looks very obvious that the question of forcing the Protestants in Ulster to become part of an autonomous Irish Home Parliament would result in insurrections within the army. And there is the possibility also that the Liberals, with their Labour allies and the Irish allies, would have to expand the armed forces just in order to implement Irish Home Rule. Such was the level of feeling and the drastic changes that were going to be brought about by the implementation of the Irish Home Rule Act, something that would essentially had to be enforced by the end of a bayonet. So, what does all of this have to do with World War One? Well, as I've mentioned, in terms of Britain's grand geopolitical geostrategic strategy, they had already defeated Russia by 1905 to 1907. They had forced Russia to accept British hegemony over much of Persia in return for Russian influence in the north. Russia had been cut out virtually of the Pacific. Japan had become a British ally. France had now entered into the British sphere of influence and was being taken away from Russia as simply a strict ally. That it's essentially, if you imagine what France and Russia were getting, it wasn't just an alliance against Germany, it was an alliance against Britain. But Britain has been able to detach France away from Russia and therefore bring Russia into Britain's orbit. All of these things were positive developments for the progression of British foreign policy. But then you add Germany into the mix, and the whole idea that Germany represented some form of existential threat to the British Empire is nonsense. The Tirpitz Plan organized the principle of German naval build-up on the idea that you have a concentrated German naval squadron in the northwest of Germany, facing into the North Sea, that could essentially be used as a way of intimidating other partners during European conferences to gain more territory, such as the Germans did in Cameroon after the Agadir crisis. But that is essentially what it was. In terms of hard naval power vis-à-vis the British, the Germans were never able to construct enough dreadnoughts to seriously compete with the British Navy, the Royal Navy. And indeed, during the First World War, this will be vindicated by the fact that the British were able to place Germany under effective blockade with horrific consequences for the domestic population throughout the duration of that war. But nevertheless, Germany, and as Winston Churchill would bring up, the spectre of Prussian militarism, whatever really that entailed, and anti-Prussian chauvinism, provided a useful pretext for the Conservatives to draw the attention away from the matter of Irish Home Rule and instead focus on matters further afield. So, in terms of the immediate cause for Conservative support, it is obvious that war in Europe provided a very useful distraction from Irish Home Rule. And the key moment here is when, on the 30th of July 1914, the Conservative Party de facto leader, Bona Law, had consented to put a lot, essentially agreed with the Liberals to put the issue of Irish Home Rule on hold until the crisis in Europe was solved. In other words, the consequences of the conflict in Europe would allow the army to focus on some form of other threat and potentially not only result in the postponement of Irish Home Rule, but terminate the whole process of Irish Home Rule altogether, perhaps bring the Irish into a closer conception of alliance with Britain, as pertaining to this conflict. And this also coincides with the actual progress and the leadership of Bona Law in general, the fact that Bona Law was able to formally integrate the liberal unionists and all stripes of unionists into the Conservative Party for the first time. So the Conservative Party, as it transitions from the leadership, the weak leadership of Arthur Balfour into Bona Law, is predicated on maintaining the union, holding Ireland as part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. So Irish Home Rule provides a very obvious pretext as to why the Conservatives would want to instigate a conflict elsewhere. And indeed, it would seem politic that given the fact that France and Russia, two great continental powers, are already at war with Germany, if Britain was to go to war with Germany at any point in the near future, now was the time. But added to that, there is another consideration. That is the more surface-level consideration, the more immediate concern. But my belief is that when one contextualizes this within the reform movement within South Africa, the creation of the Union of South Africa, the fact that so many figures who are responsible for policy making within the Colonial Office at the time are coming out of this experience of the Boer War, the idea that is forming is that of the Imperial Federation. So what does war, what does conscription, what does statism as a result of the First World War provide for the Conservatives? It allows potentially for all of the white settler colonies to unite around the mother nation in defeating the Hun, in defeating Prussian militarism. So as Irish Home Rule, the postponement and termination of Irish Home Rule, is used as an immediate pretext to bring the Conservatives over to the side for the course of war, so the prospect of creating a conflict to unite the empire in opposition to another is a broader and more lasting consequence, potentially, of bringing Britain into that conflict against Germany. The irony, of course, of all of these lofty gains, proposals regarding the future of the British Empire, focusing on Prussia as another, potentially seeing Germany and Russia destroy themselves in the process, which ultimately transpires by 1918, and allowing the British Empire to become an empire in fact and not only in name, by integrating all these colonies together. In fact, the opposite happens. As a result of the experience in Gallipoli, for example, we see the advent of a burgeoning Australian nationalism. Within the colonies themselves, we see the exacerbation of independence sentiments. And the whole concept of Anzac as something independent from Britain is really the cause, is really the consequence of the First World War. So it has the opposite effect. Rather than galvanizing an imperial Commonwealth sentiment, it provides a justification for these white settler colonies, the Dominions, to leave the British Empire. But the Conservatives never abandon this position throughout the course of the war. In fact, they are accelerators in this position. They intensify their commitment for conflict. David Lloyd George is simultaneously part of government, yet he's also the government's greatest critic. He is moving away from his party comrades, the Liberal Party, and he joins with the Conservative War Hawks in 1916 and pushes for more government controls on the economy, more intervention, essentially seeing the Prussian model as a model for Britain to emulate. And of course, Prussia was, with the advent of Prussian socialism, was far more statist than historically liberal Britain. And combined with that, with the notion of universal male conscription, even applying to married men, these are concepts which are so alien to the British psyche, and yet by 1915, led by figures such as Milner, there was a huge advocacy for them, and by 1916 they effectively became state policy. The idea that Britain should expand the scale of the state and use all of the resources of empire to bring Germany to heel and to destroy Germany, without realizing that the more that Britain asked from the empire, the less that the empire essentially believed that they would receive from Britain. The lack of reciprocal obligations, the fact that Britain was asking so much, essentially rebounded, almost like the American War of Independence, in the sense that the colonies were asking for more autonomy as a consequence. And this is a process that would repeat with the Second World War and accelerate the end of empire. So if we are to look at the conservative cause which ultimately seduces David Lloyd George and has an active fellow traveller in someone like Winston Churchill, all of the ostensible aims which bring those factions to support the cause of war in 1914 fail. They fail miserably. The British Empire is essentially a doomed project. And even in the 1930s, there is an aspect of defeatism and nihilism permeating throughout the policy of appeasement. And appeasement not just against Germany, but appeasement in all senses of the empire, when referring to Ireland and when referring to China. But of course, if the postponement and perhaps elimination of the prospect of Irish Home Rule was also the immediate desire of the Conservatives to get embroiled in that conflict, one needs to consider that during the conflict, we have the Easter Rising, and within a few short years after 1918, the more moderate Irish Home Rule Party has been replaced by the Irish Republican Party, Sinn Féin. Not only will Sinn Féin be able to force the government into a position of recognition of an Irish Free State, albeit with Northern Ireland separated. But Fianna Fáil, the party that will succeed under the leadership of Éamon de Valera, will basically lead Ireland to total independence from Britain, removing the trappings of the Free State, the idea of essentially of Ireland as mimicking that of Canada or the various other dominions. So if Bona Law had been able to unite the conservative factions on the eve of war behind the cause of empire and behind the cause of unionism, the actual consequences of the First World War were the negation and destruction of both of these causes, which, if anything, as per my exposition at the beginning of this lecture, compounds the tragedy of the First World War. I want to end this lecture with an epilogue on the situation in Belgium. Belgium is very useful and important in a sense in that it provided a moral pretext, a justification to become embroiled in the conflict. A few days before the German declaration of war on Russia, Edward Grey had given a half-hearted attempt to detach France from her obligations to Russia to ensure that there would only be a war on the Eastern Front. This, of course, was ultimately futile due to the fundamental nature of the dual alliance between France and Russia, whereby they were reciprocally obligated to defend one another, and German strategic planning was predicated upon that point of defeating both powers in tandem. The point that concerned Britain, therefore, with the defence of France was the 1812 Entente Cordiale that delineated spheres of influence in terms of naval defence: France in the Western Mediterranean and Britain in the English Channel. This agreement left France in a weak position given the German naval build-up at the beginning of the 20th century and the fact that they didn't have sufficient naval power to block German naval access into the English Channel. Nevertheless, even with that obligation and the threat which Winston Churchill could whip up of German ships entering the English Channel and possibly even using it as a front to attack Britain is overestimated in the sense that all Britain could have done in this situation is send an ultimatum to Germany should they have decided to place ships in the English Channel, and it would have served the same purpose as the invasion of Belgium in terms of providing Britain with a convenient pretext had the Germans decided to exploit the French weakness in the English Channel. So what ultimately is the purpose of Belgium in this scenario, given that it's the most often brought up reason rather than pretext as to why Britain got involved in this conflict? As I've tried to prove in this lecture, all the reasons, all the political motivations for the forces that brought Britain into conflict already existed at the end of July, and Belgium therefore simply provided a justification for said conflict. But more than that, Belgium had a particular influence on the career of David Lloyd George, and it is to David Lloyd George that I really believe that Belgium pertains the most significance. Given the fact that the Asquith government could only really commit to war, in the same sense that the Conservatives were already committed to war, the conversion of David Lloyd George to the cause of Belgium essentially ensured that he would be the leading light in the war going forward. He had embraced a populist cause over the more coherent war objectives of the Conservatives and people like Edward Grey, who had been responsible for British foreign policy up until that point. He had understood the prevailing mood of the public. He had seized upon the quote-unquote atrocities of the Germans and their flagrant disregard for international law in violating the Belgian neutrality that Prussia before had been sworn to uphold as ample justification to provide his own dramatic Road to Damascus moment, his own conversion to the cause of war as a crusade against German-Prussian imperialism. David Lloyd George was, in a sense, absolved from any of the capricious motivations of the politicians who surrounded him. And as the people's as the people's champion, in the same way that he had championed the people's budget 5 years before, or rather 4 years before, and been able to face down the House of Lords over this issue. In becoming the populist war leader, David Lloyd George would go on to confirm this again when he would launch his own coup against Prime Minister Asquith in 1916 and lead the war effort. So I see this as a careerist move for David Lloyd George, one in which he will become immortalised for this, in the same way that Winston Churchill became immortalised after the Battle of Britain in his role in defeating Nazi Germany. However, I do not believe that any of this changes the actual cause for war. Rather, this is simply a question of changing of the guard. Had the Liberal government fallen over this issue, had David Lloyd George not become convinced of the cause of defending Belgium's neutrality, the likelihood is that figures such as Winston Churchill and Edward Grey would have defected to the Conservative Party, and war would have become an inevitability regardless. This pretext of Belgium simply ensured that David Lloyd George would become immortalised in the conflict as Britain's war leader. But nevertheless, even if Belgium gave a moral gloss to the conflict between Germany and Britain, the motivations pertaining to the preservation of empire and the preservation of Ireland, Belgium serving as a pretext for this great gambit to preserve all of these things, the Unionist cause and the British Empire, to rejuvenate and lead to a possible centralisation of the dominions under the leadership of the home country. All of this came to naught. Brit and Belgium itself was occupied and devastated. Indeed, had Britain not got involved, the likelihood is that the occupation of Belgium by Germany would have lasted considerably less time. So for all the grandstanding and moralising of people like David Lloyd George, Belgium was essentially sacrificed in order for Britain to find that convenient pretext for joining. It should not surprise us at all when we look at certain figures like Winston Churchill, who had already committed themselves to the cause of war to defeat the quote-unquote Prussian menace, that he was found jumping up and down at the news that Britain already had a reason, but now it had a pretext for joining said conflict. But all this should do is serve to underline how cynical the whole motivations of Britain involving themselves in this conflict are. And why do I believe Britain's motivations for joining in this conflict are cynical? Because unlike France, and unlike Germany, and even to a lesser extent Austria-Hungary and Russia, the war did not represent a direct threat in terms of an imminent invasion of their countries. However, you can defend this and say that some, mainly conservative politicians and members of the Round Table, may have considered this an existential obligation of the British to get involved and embroiled in the conflict in order to solidify the empire in opposition to another. And that in itself is a far more self-serving and disingenuous aim when one relates it to the very real concerns of invasion which threatened the other continental powers in Europe. Thank you for listening.